The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
The movie was called The Sand Pebbles, and it was really, in a real sense, more about the war in Vietnam, I think, but the whole background was China in the early 20th century, and it was played off sort of, it was the story of an American gunboat that was plying up and down this river in China, and the interaction with missionaries in China. If it still comes around on the Late Show, and it might be worth seeing, you know, just from that point of view. The Sand Pebbles. It gives you quite a picture of how the Americans viewed the Chinese in those years, and it's a really sad one, sort of like watching the conclusion of MASH. But anyway, I think to a real degree, its effort to sort of show the way in which the American government was seen by the Chinese is pretty accurate, just as a general, as a sweeping generalization. And, well, for example, I think that this is why you had such strong reaction after Mao took over the island, over the mainland, you had such strong reaction to the presence of the missionaries in the Christian church. Because the Christian church was perceived as one more foreign type of institution. And it was perceived not so much as a purveyor, as a bringer of the gospel, as it was as a bringer of American motivations and colonialist interest in China. And so what was rejected then may not necessarily have been the gospel so much as it was that those kinds of Western of perceptions of the gospel as a Western thing. And I think that's important to see even when you're presenting the gospel here. So a culture can reject the gospel not because it's foreign, but because the evangelist who presents it can seem foreign. Hudson Taylor, you remember, when he went to China, got into quite a bit of controversy because he insisted that those missionaries who were working with him had to wear Chinese clothing. And the men had to wear pigtails, and they, even in the practices in the home, for example, they were not allowed to use knives and forks. They had to use chopsticks in eating. There was a lot of controversy in the mission that, in fact, one of the controversies was called the chopsticks controversy because of the resistance on the part of those missionaries even to that adaptation. If you're interested in this, a very interesting biography of Hudson Taylor is by John Pollock, called Hudson Taylor and Maria, and it's framed around the love story between Hudson Taylor and his first wife. But it's a very interesting biography, and you'll find a whole chapter in there on the chopsticks controversy. But I think that what Taylor was doing was sort of, you know, he was sensing in a real way and far beyond his time that you had to assume or take on Chinese culture, at least in some real forms, in order to avoid unnecessary offense. In an animistic system where ritual works is at the core of the system, what the missionary may assume to be harmless customs or the results of the gospel are taken by the animist to be the gospel itself. And so you've got to be careful there. For example, in Korea, if you're doing evangelistic work, one method I always use is very simply just to get things going by asking somebody on the street or in a marketplace, are you a Christian? Are you a believer in Jesus? And very, very frequently, the answer was almost always, I cannot be a Christian, I smoke. Or, are you a Christian? And somebody would say, no, I drink. I think that apart from our attitudes towards smoking and drinking, what's important in that answer is the perception that the hearer has about what it takes to be a Christian. He doesn't say, no, I can't believe in Jesus, the Son of God, or no, I'm afraid I'm not interested in repenting of my sins. It's no, I smoke. So you've got sort of a works kind of mentality there in that person's mind, and what he or she has done has perceived sort of the outward kind of accoutrements of the gospel in the church. He's perceived, for example, that Christians in Korea don't smoke and Christians in Korea don't drink, and therefore, in order to be a Christian, you don't smoke and you don't drink. He knows very little about Jesus, but he knows that. That then becomes, I think that's partly what Tippett's getting at here. The animist identifies the practices of the Christian faith with the gospel itself. You know, he's got this whole ritual works kind of way of looking at the world, so that's how he's going to do it. I think from that point of view, you've got to be very careful about how you answer a question like that. You don't, at that stage, to my mind, proceed to give this person a temperance lecture. Instead, you try to get him out of that by talking about what the heart of the Christian gospel is, that it's a message about grace and not about whether you smoke or drink or whether you work or, not, or whether you work on Sunday or not. I have been with evangelists in Korea who, when they've heard that response, have done that. They've literally begun then talking about, well, it's not right for you to drink, or Koreans usually get drunk when they start drinking. And I suggest that that's a very poor way to respond to that kind of response. It doesn't understand what is behind the response. Typically, here's another way of approaching the problem of meaning. There may also be a blurring of the meaning of the gospel in the message itself. That is to say, in the theological emphasis of the evangelist. Does the gospel come through as in a foreign garment? Is it presented as sort of a moral code, some sort of legal system? In a Confucian culture, this may result in a total misunderstanding of the gospel. For example, the word righteousness is a word that is also at the key of the heart of Confucianism. It's in fact the term that is used in both the Mandarin language and in the Korean language is the same in the Bible to describe the righteousness of God which is in Christ. It's a word that is borrowed from the Confucian classics. So it comes then in the ear of the ordinary people with that kind of meaning all built into it. And the danger can be then that when they hear about the righteousness of God, they're starting to think about the fivefold relationships and how to have proper relationships with your older brother, how to have proper relationships with the king, how to have proper relationships with the wife, all these kinds of things, with the older brother. And what is missing then is the whole concept of God as the one who is just and holy and altogether different and set apart from sinners. That's missing because we haven't focused on it. What words, for example, are you going to use in your culture to translate theos? Are you aware of the fact that that the word that may be used in your Bible, in your cultural language, to translate that is a word that already has a prior meaning in the ears of those to whom you're sharing the gospel? Are you sensitive to the fact that when they hear your word, they don't hear all of the biblical content that you have back here but don't verbalize? Instead, they hear only what they're used to in terms of their cultural setting. So the message gets blurred. Among the Tiv people in Nigeria, with whom Norm's worked a lot, apparently there is a traditional cultic name for the high god. Eugene Rubin, whom I mentioned yesterday, uses this term, Alando, right?
Yeah, I don't know much about the Tiv.
Oh, good. Well then, as I was saying,
yeah, really your lecture.
Okay, now actually this didn't come from Rubing. I was But
I have his book in my briefcase.
Oh. Well, another source I use. You have to establish your identity as a teacher. Aondo was apparently the traditional cultic name for the high god among the Tiv people. And this high god among the Tiv abides in distant majesty. He's what would be called the distant god or the hidden god, the Deus Otiosus. Because of this high god depend the blessing or the cursing of the whole Tiv people. Now, the missionary, in going to the Tiv people, took that name in order to translate Theos in the Bible, in the Tiv Bible. So, says Rubing, both the traditional view, that is the African traditional view, has now been colored by the Christian use of the term, and the Christian view of God has been colored by the traditional one. You have this mixing. You know, cultures, remember, are not things that sort of always exist separately, but whenever worldviews come into contact, there is a mixing that takes place. And since cultures are always dynamic things, our struggle is how to keep the mixing from taking place in such a way that the Christian view or the Christian meaning, you know, doesn't get infiltrated by unbiblical concepts that may come from the culture that it's coming in contact with. So, for example, says Rubing, there is a fatalism among the Tiv people. He says they will they shrug their shoulders when they face adversity, and they say, with all the overtones of the old worldview, it's Aondo. You know, what can you do? Sort of a Doris Day theology, you know. Que sera, sera. Now, this fatalism provides a means of absolving one from personal blame if there's a calamity. It's not my fault. It's Aondo. And then you can proof text that, of course, with Romans 8:28. It's Aondo's will. What can I do to withstand the will of Aondo? And in doing that, then, Aondo's will becomes very arbitrary, and it is useless, says Rubing, to attempt to contravene his design. You don't know it, and there's no way you can get in touch. He's the high, distant god. He's not with us. So, says Rubing, among the Tiv Christians, there is a lack of use of personal ability and personal opportunity. And this is frequently excused on theological grounds. And you can see the mixing. Do you have anything similar to that among the Hausa, Norm?
Oh, yeah. We have exactly that same. Huh? Our problem with our people is that they're using the Hausa language, which is really a lot of Islamic Arabic roots, and all the words for our Christian expression are taken directly from Islam, including Allah and everything, right down the line. So then I think they combine that with their animistic, which is very close to the Islamic view of God as being some great fate, you know, out there.
Yeah.
And so anything that happens virtually is, well, nothing you can do. I mean, it's just the way it is.
Yeah.
I think that's just in African culture all over this fatalism.
You know, one of the things that hits me is in reading through this stuff again, I wonder if this is part of the reason why, at least I sense very often, a difficulty on the part of African evangelical churches to sort of get involved in the process of, call it, nation building or development, or putting it more biblically, to function as leaven or salt, you know, in their society. God sort of is so distant and passive, as it were, that they end up being passive too. You know, corruption, governments, a Christian political leader goes bad. Well, what can you do about it? You know, it's the will of God, and so you tend to withdraw into the church, and the church becomes kind of a cocoon that surrounds you and keeps you safe from the imbalance. I get the same feeling, for example, when I struggle with the Korean church's relationship to the state at the present time, and sense that that there's more than just more than just what I would feel to be an incorrect reading of Romans 13 involved. There's also a lot of pacifism that comes from Confucianism, in which that influences the church and makes it sort of stand back and say, well, what can you do about it? This isn't the business of the church anyway. To give one more example, I think Tippett used this one. The animists, remember, have come from a world of power encounter. Presumably they need a god who speaks and demonstrates with power. Now, the preaching of a purely ethical gospel will not touch them. But a life transformed by the living power of God will lead to a new ethic. And so you'll find very frequently, says Tippett, the rise within these settings, animistic settings, therefore, of these African independent church movements, and centering, as they often do, around a power figure, the prophet leader of the group. And his message, then, is usually one that is centered frequently around the concept of power, the power of the divine word, but ministered through him. You see an attempt through all of that to breach, this kind of passive gap, but it's coming the wrong way. You know, it doesn't flow out of a biblical direction of concern. And that means something's gone wrong with where we've come from.
When we were at Ventnor, we saw a film, the African Independent Churches, and Tom and I were talking on our way back. After seeing the film, we said that the only problem is the title. It should be called the Independent African Religions rather than churches.
Yeah. One of the struggles, I think, that we haven't really dealt with statistically in terms of demographics is how ready to see the African independent movements. David Barrett's book that some of you probably worked with through Roger, I think includes all those movements in his argument that Africa south of the Sahara by the end of this century will have become Christian. And that's a big question about just how Christian are these African independent churches. But Hank.
Yeah, it's just that each one has to be evaluated separately, because there are some that are quite close biblically.
Often
they've been because of some kind of personality clash between leadership. But then there are others that are just way off left field that people may call Christians. So that's why it's difficult to say when you start compiling statistics.
Good point.
How many of these churches are there?
They call them 6,000.
And they're all independent. They don't have any relationship with...
No relationship to a Western or foreign mission. That's it.
But I mean relationship to each other.
Some of them are large enough and are cross-national. For example, the Kimbanguist Church is one of the largest, if not the largest, in Africa. And that moves across all kinds of country lines. But many of them are quite localized. David Barrett's first book was called Schism and Renewal in Africa. And it's the history of 2,000 of these independent churches in Kenya alone. Now, you can document all the data from another area where the independent churches have grown significantly is South Africa and Southern Africa. And a scholar who has done a lot of work, two scholars have done a lot of work in the South African setting, are G.C. Oosthuizen and Bengt Sunkler. And Oosthuizen is a Calvinist. He's a member of the Afrikaner Church. And he has a book called Erdmans published about 10 years ago called Post-Christianity in Africa, in which he also tries to evaluate the African independent churches. That's a good book for those of you who haven't come across it. And the other one is a very famous Lutheran bishop, Bengt Sunkler, and he has a number of books out on this area. One of the most recent ones is called Zulu Zion, and it's about an African independent church which is formed among the Zulu people. Part of my frustration sometimes with the movements is not so much with the movements as with what seems to me a really heavy, almost across the boards, reluctance on the part of evangelicals to want to touch them at all. I think some of that may come from the thing that Hank's warning us against, you know, our tendency to sort of lump them all into one group, sort of as what we would call here in the United States cults. And, you know, you don't necessarily say, I'm going to become a Jehovah's Witness, you know, so I can evangelize within the kingdom halls. But on the other hand, there are many of these churches that have even more than other churches in Africa and the third world, profound lack of teaching. And this could conceivably be a place where missionaries could fulfill a very useful function. Norm?
The difficulty with that, we have one particularly in our area, is that the church that I work with, for example, and the organization just simply won't.
Yeah.
They'll throw you out of there, Pastor.
You've almost got to come out uniquely to work with them.
You've got to come out.
Same.
Yeah.
You can't do, because they've usually broken off from the group that the mission group works with, and they're seen as really.
Yeah.
Maybe then, as part of mission strategy, if that's true, then our boards have got to be encouraged to think about designating people whose job would be specifically to try and make connections with those churches that they feel they can for purposes of instruction. The Mennonites have done a great deal of work in some of these churches, and they are the only group I know of that has sort of specifically put them on their agenda, have gone in among the churches and engaged in a very fruitful teaching ministry. More recently, one that's closer to us, some of you may be interested in, a Westminster graduate of about 6-7 years ago by the name of Keith Underhill is working in Nairobi in Kenya. He is planning Reformed Baptist churches there in Nairobi. And Keith has been approached by one of the largest African independent churches located in the north of Kenya, who have come to him and asked him to be their teacher. And some of you who took the course last semester in Christian ministry in the third world had an opportunity to look at his proposed curriculum agenda for the teaching in that school church. I will say no more. But, you know, there are people who are attempting to build those bridges and make those connections. But often, as I said, their very existence comes because of some blurring in terms of the message itself that I think ought to put us alert to it. Okay, third minor point here. There can also be a blurring at the acceptor end, that is, by the convert. And, you know, biblically, the example of Paul and Barnabas at Lystra, Acts chapter 14, I think it's a beautiful example of this. The people there, the two men heal the cripple, and the people at Lystra take the healing to mean that the two evangelists were the Greek gods, Mercury and Jupiter, sort of come in human form. The proclamation had been faithfully given, but it was misunderstood by the receptor. Now, Tippett then comments, this incident reminds the evangelist of the great need for being aware of the worldview of the listener. The miracle had been reinterpreted in terms of the Lystra mythology. And this, I think, is the core problem of all interpretation. Or, put it another way, of translation. Every word selected, the word for God, the word for Spirit, the word for Son of God, the word for sin, the word for love, the word for atonement, all these words come from a non-biblical worldview. You don't invent these words. This, in a real way, was the, you know, is the great advantage of the English language, and specifically the King James translation. They could do that, because of the correlations or the connections between the Greek language and the English language. So, for example, the translators of the King James and the English usage, rather than fiddle with how to translate baptizo, just simply transliterated it. And it fit into the, you know, it came, fitted comfortably into our English usage, but still, you know, the whole question of the meaning we struggled with. In Korea, for example, that translation question is a burning question. There's violent disagreement usually among between the Baptists and everybody else on this question. And so the Baptists have their own word, their own translation for baptize, a word which is shared, as far as I know, by no one else within the ecclesiastical world in Korea. Okay. All right, let's go on to number three, and I think that's Ian, right? Yeah.
Chapter five.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But in terms of your outline, yeah. We're working now on the third religious, the third magnetic point of religion, okay? That would be I and the riddle of my existence.
Bavinck begins by just drawing out some of the common day occurrences that illustrate to us the fact that in life we're aware of the fact that there are active aspects of life and there are passive aspects of life. In the passive area, for instance, just in a biological sense, we have no control over the fact our heart beats. Digestion, for instance, is a non-controllable function. And he carries that even to the point of saying the country that we're born in, for instance, is something we have no control over, the family that we're born into. Even the education that we get is something that's given to us. So there are definitely passive aspects of our lives that draw out that principle in the human experience, passivity. At the same time, he does make clear that even some of these passive experiences that we have in life do involve some active participation, such as breathing. The respiratory function is passive, yet at the same time we can stop breathing for a certain period of time, hopefully not too long. And even related to digestion, we can, obviously digestion is a passive thing, but at the same time we can control that by eating or not eating. So, and again, he's just drawing in common day occurrences to draw up this aspect of activity and passivity. He says, in terms of man's experience, probably the area of activity that we sense the most is the fact that we react to the circumstances and to the conditions that we have in life. If I get a gas bill from the gas company that's five times what it should be, then my active aspect of life comes to play, and I usually get on the phone and holler at the lady on the other end of the phone, who is the woman at the gas works, which illustrates the fact that we do have this reaction process. Things happen to us, but at the same time we react to them. His point is that this relationship between activity and passivity has a tremendous implication in the area of religion, and it's a question that religion has to address. He illustrates the way some religious systems deal with this relationship. He begins with Mesopotamian religions, or the astral religions, those religions that draw heavily from the stars, the heavens, and the control that the heavens and the stars have over man's experience. And in the relationship between the heavens and man in Mesopotamian religions, man is viewed as just a small part of the cosmic family. And heaven obviously takes precedent over anything that man does. The gods who are controlling everything are the ones who even put men into power, and they can either remove their blessing or can continue their blessing on this person, which either determines his success or failure. Basically speaking, he has no control over these things. Man is completely dependent upon the powers of the astral functions in the heavens. So he is, in a sense, victimized by a capricious system that's, if we like this guy for a while, then we'll give him power and blessing. If we don't, we'll just remove it. So that, in a sense, the active aspect of this person is very limited. He really can't act. He's a victim of this great power that hangs over him. He illustrates that Hinduism is quite different. For one thing, it's not astral. And from another perspective, in the Hindu system, man is not divorced from the world of gods and demons and heroes and giants and the forces of order and chaos. They're found within human society, and they're actually found within the individual himself. He's a part of the cosmos. It's not them and us. He is a part of the process and a part of the cosmos. Now, he illustrates, or he brings out the fact that this does not negate the fact that man is sort of carried along in this current or in this river of the cosmos and is somewhat helpless. But at the same time, he draws some illustrations from particularly a story of Draupadi and Pedambas that talks of this human predicament of the individual being caught in the cosmic powers and being forced along by them. But at the same time, there's illustrations of people rebelling against these cosmic forces and cosmic powers. Even the illustrations themselves, man is viewed as a wooden puppet on a string, which is a very unnatural concept. Also, a bird being held by a string attached to a tree, or a tree falling into a raging stream. Obviously the natural situation for a bird is to have freedom, to be able to fly where it wants to fly, and trees are not supposed to be inundated by water. But the reality of life says that we are birds that are tied by the cosmic forces, and we are trees that have been engulfed by the cosmic flood, and we're being pushed along. But at the same time, there's that desire to rebel against this. And so in the Hindu system, at least there's a dialogue between the reality of the activity and passivity. He brought out an interesting point about the concept of tragedy in the Hindu system in comparison to the obvious emphasis of the tragedy in the Greek system. And his point was that within the Hindu system, there's no concept of absolute contrast. Where we see in the Greek system, you've got the individual fighting against the gods, and it's them and us. And somehow the individual in the Greek system is being unfairly dealt with. And his only reaction, of course, is to fight against these powers that try and inundate him. Whereas the concept in the Hindu system is that man addresses his relationship in a more uncertain way to the cosmos. Hinduism also thwarts the tendency of total control through the concept of transcendence, that there is that part of man that can transcend and in a sense stand as an independent observer of life and not be swallowed up in this system. This disattachment, so the person is never completely consumed, or at least has the potential never to be completely consumed in the process, where this is not true in the Greek system. You have no choice. You are consumed, and therefore the only thing you can do is to fight back, whereas we have the concepts of the Greek tragedies. Then he goes in to illustrate this in the Islamic system, and I think I sense from what he's doing in Chapter 5 is illustrating how these things are addressed in the different religious systems, but he's also trying to show us that these issues and problems are not really addressed well, that it's kind of a futile question that's never really dealt with and never really satisfactorily answered. In the Islamic system, of course, the big question is, are all of our actions predestined by Allah, and are we ourselves entirely powerless? And he goes on to illustrate some of the ways that this question has been addressed and the different ways that Islamic tradition has looked at that question. He talks about the Qadarites, I assume I'm pronouncing that correctly, who argue for man's self-determination, because not to argue for man's self-determination would produce an immorality. In other words, if there's no self-determination, if we're completely passive, then we may as well just go ahead and do what we want, because Allah willed it anyway. So it tends to remove the whole conflict away from human responsibility. Later, this was adopted by another group, and they decided that not all of human life was a product of Allah's qadar, or divine command. After all, if it was, how could Allah righteously punish people? It would be impossible if everything that we did and our life's patterns could be attributed to the qada or the divine command. So that's the way they get around this apparent contradiction. Then he talked about Orthodox Islam, And the solution, which is kind of interesting, the solution, as far as they're concerned, is couched in the word KASB, K-A-S-B. Is that pronounced correctly? Or is that close enough? Don't worry about it. And that's the idea of acquisition or appropriation. So man is in the process of acquiring or appropriating the things that Allah has provided for him. So that, granted, man is somewhat passive because Allah is providing these circumstances, is providing these situations for him, but man is active because he acquires them and he appropriates them. So that's how this issue is dealt within the context of Orthodox Islam. And it almost sounds like the parallel theological debate that we have, I think, with the Calvinistic circles, is the ideas of appropriation. I think those who perhaps would have more of an Arminian perspective would say that man does have something to do in salvation because he has to appropriate the gospel. He has to accept it or ingest it. Whereas I think more strongly Reformed people would say that God gives the person even the ability to do that. So it's much more passive from that standpoint. Towards the end of his discussion, he brings out the point that the most important question facing religious systems is how do religious systems consider human life? Is man completely passive? Therefore, human life is almost a secondary thing to consider and the deity is primary? Or is there some dignity? Is there some reality to the whole aspect of human life? Are we just amoebas, blobs, something that's pushed along by wind or by wave? Or, in a real sense, is there a certain dignity and power and intrinsic value in human life? He brings out a point made by Reinhold Niebuhr, who said that man is unique among all creatures because he has the ability of self-transcendence. He can sense the difference between the I and the other. He senses that he is different from the rest of the world around him, and that he is unique in that sense from other created beings. And I think there's something to be said for that. Although he did bring out that this was rejected by Spinoza. Spinoza felt that God is the ultimate ground, and being in the universe is perfect reason, and that we and our deepest being are one with him. So there's no separation between the I and the other, because God is the ultimate all-inclusive ground and we are in him. Therefore, all that confusing stuff says that this concept of the I and the other and man's ability to see himself as apart from the other is really not valid in his system. But again, restated, as Bobbitt comes back to again, he says the key statement is, what does man experience when he uses the word I, and by so doing keeps aloof from the world as other? And what does that all mean? In considering this question, he said there's various reactions that people have in religious systems. And the first reaction is that they do protest against the idea of being just a particle in the cosmos. Naturally, people reject that idea and fight against that. And he's illustrated that by the religious debates, either within Islam or Hinduism, the concept of the Greek tragedy. The people deep down inside really don't like the concept that there's some kind of a particle or some kind of an object that can be pushed in whatever direction within the cosmos. The second reaction, which is almost the other side of the coin, is that in a certain sense, it's kind of handy to feel as though you're a particle in the cosmos, because then you can adopt the fatalism and a passivity to the point where you say, I'm not responsible. It's not my fault. I have no control over it, which is something we just mentioned before. He mentioned that Hinduism attempts to fight against this reality in the concept of the karma, which, if I remember rightly, is the effect of action. It's the automatic law of justice. But even within the Hindu system, ultimately, the karma is applied to us. We really don't have any ultimate control over the karma. Am I interpreting that correctly? I'm getting a half nod from Palus, so I guess I haven't made any heretical statements yet. And he brings out an interesting point at the end, and he talks about the Maya, which is the Hindu concept that our life is really kind of a casual projected dream that a God has for us, and that granted we may have some input or some control when it comes to karma, but even ultimately he illustrated this by a story in his chapter, and I won't go into all the details, but the point of the story was that the person's experience in life was really just a dream that a God had had, and there was no way that the person could avoid the eventual outcome of that dream. And that, in essence, is what he says in Chapter 5 in this whole discussion. Are we going to have questions and discuss it that way? Or?
That'd be a good idea.
Okay, does anybody have questions? You can throw some of these things around.
How about, do you see, Ian, in terms of your ministry in the city, you hear this question being raised? How?
I think there's a sense in the contacts that I have with people in the city, a high sense of fatalism. And I don't think it's necessarily borrowed from any particular religious tradition. I think it's borrowed from misconceptions that we have in our country concerning God. I've worked with young people in this city who see their lot in life as something that they have absolutely no control over, and that they've exhausted blaming mother, father, aunts and uncles, etc., and now they finally come to the ultimate extreme, and that is to blame God and say, it's his fault, he's the one who did this to me, and in a sense, what can I do? I'm a victim of circumstance, and ultimately God is the God of circumstance. Therefore, the God that you're preaching to me is one that I want nothing to do with, because he's given me a raw deal. So I think there's a sense in which that's addressed. To react to that, I think it's significant, and he brings this out even more clearly in Chapter 13, is the biblical concept that where the Bible doesn't necessarily address the idea of how much will does a human have, but how much responsibility does the individual human being have. And I think in dealing with people who have that perception of God, we've got to help them understand responsibility. And then they can begin to understand this concept of activity and what they can do themselves, and give them a more balanced perspective on who God is and his dealings with men.
I think many Koreans have a fatalism and a passivity. I talked to some Buddhists, and why don't you accept Jesus Christ? Mm-hmm. The time that they said that if I accept Jesus, and then my God, you know, the Buddhist, the Buddha or another the supreme being give me a disease. Disaster to him or his family, so I can't accept Jesus Christ. So I think there are many they have another religion, but the fatalism that comes upon their mankind mentality.
The Hindu idea of karma is not that they are not responsible for their action. What it says is that even if they do some good deed today, its results may not be visible in this life. It may come after, 100,000 cycles of birth and rebirth, etc. So it leads to some kind of fatalism. Even if I'm going to do something good, what is going to happen? Nothing is going to happen to me today, tomorrow, or in this life. So who bothers? Next life I may be a bird or an animal.
And isn't it true that if they don't fulfill the karma, that in reincarnation they'll be dropped to a lower caste, perhaps as a punishment for not doing properly?
Not as a result of your actions in this life. It depends upon the cumulative result of your past action in all the previous lives put together.
Well, again, I sense from reading this chapter that Bhavink is trying to illustrate that religions in general really cannot satisfactorily answer the question of what is human life, what is the relationship between activity and passivity, and what about this question of I and the other? I mean, exactly what is the human existence as it relates to supreme deities? And I think my feeling from all of these is that they all eventually lead to a fatalism, and they all have within them that trap door you can push where the bottom can fall out and you can say, I had no control. Whereas, as he goes into his discussion in chapter 13, which is obviously related, Christianity has a different perspective. And the reason being, in my perspective from reading it, is that Christianity deals with responsibility in very specific terms, which gives a person a matrix to begin to understand how they do relate to God.
The movie was called The Sand Pebbles. And it was really, in a real sense, more about the war in Vietnam, I think. But the whole background was China in the early 20th century. And it was played off sort of, it was the story of an American gunboat that was plying up and down this river in China. And the interaction with missionaries in China. If it still comes around on the Late Show, and it might be worth seeing, you know, just from that point of view. The Sand Pebbles. It gives you quite a picture of how the Americans viewed the Chinese in those years, and it's a really sad one, sort of like watching the conclusion of MASH. But anyway, I think to a real degree, its effort to sort of show the way in which the American government was seen by the Chinese is pretty accurate, just as a general, as a sweeping generalization. And, well, for example, I think that this is why you had such strong reaction after Mao took over the island, over the mainland, you had such strong reaction to the presence of the missionaries in the Christian church. Because the Christian church was perceived as one more foreign type of institution. And it was perceived not so much as a purveyor, as a bringer of the gospel, as it was as a bringer of American motivations and colonialist interest in China. And so what was rejected then may not necessarily have been the gospel so much as it was that those kinds of Western of perceptions of the gospel as a Western thing. And I think that's important to see even when you're presenting the gospel here. So a culture can reject the gospel not because it's foreign, but because the evangelist who presents it can seem foreign. Hudson Taylor, you remember, when he went to China, got into quite a bit of controversy because he insisted that those missionaries who were working with him had to wear Chinese clothing. And the men had to wear pigtails, and they even in the practices in the home, for example, they were not allowed to use knives and forks. They had to use chopsticks in eating. There was a lot of controversy in the mission that, in fact, one of the controversies was called the chopsticks controversy because of the resistance on the part of those missionaries even to that adaptation. If you're interested in this, a very interesting biography of Hudson Taylor is by John Pollock, called Hudson Taylor and Maria, and it's framed around the love story between Hudson Taylor and his first wife. But it's a very interesting biography, and you'll find a whole chapter in there on the chopsticks controversy. But I think that what Taylor was doing was sort of, you know, he was sensing in a real way and far beyond his time that you had to assume or take on Chinese culture, at least in some real forms, in order to avoid unnecessary offense. In an animistic system where ritual works is at the core of the system, what the missionary may assume to be harmless customs or the results of the gospel are taken by the animist to be the gospel itself. And so you've got to be careful there. For example, in Korea, if you're doing evangelistic work, one method I always use is very simply just to get things going by asking somebody on the street or in a marketplace, are you a Christian? Are you a believer in Jesus? And very, very frequently, the answer was almost always, I cannot be a Christian, I smoke. Or, are you a Christian? And somebody would say, no, I drink. I think that apart from our attitudes towards smoking and drinking, what's important in that answer is the perception that the hearer has about what it takes to be a Christian. He doesn't say, no, I can't believe in Jesus, the Son of God, or no, I'm afraid I'm not interested in repenting of my sins. It's no, I smoke. So you've got sort of a works kind of mentality there in that person's mind, and what he or she has done has perceived sort of the outward kind of accoutrements of the gospel in the church. He's perceived, for example, that Christians in Korea don't smoke and Christians in Korea don't drink, and therefore, in order to be a Christian, you don't smoke and you don't drink. He knows very little about Jesus, but he knows that. That then becomes, I think that's partly what Tippett's getting at here. The animist identifies the practices of the Christian faith with the gospel itself. You know, he's got this whole ritual works kind of way of looking at the world, so that's how he's going to do it. I think from that point of view, you've got to be very careful about how you answer a question like that. You don't, at that stage, to my mind, proceed to give this person a temperance lecture. Instead, you try to get him out of that by talking about what the heart of the Christian gospel is, that it's a message about grace and not about whether you smoke or drink or whether you work or not, or whether you work on Sunday or not. I have been with evangelists in Korea who, when they've heard that response, have done that. They've literally begun then talking about, well, it's not right for you to drink, or Koreans usually get drunk when they start drinking. And I suggest that that's a very poor way to respond to that kind of response. It doesn't understand what is behind the response. Typically, here's another way of approaching the problem of meaning. There may also be a blurring of the meaning of the gospel in the message itself. That is to say, in the theological emphasis of the evangelist. Does the gospel come through as in a foreign garment? Is it presented as sort of a moral code, some sort of legal system? In a Confucian culture, this may result in a total misunderstanding of the gospel. For example, the word righteousness is a word that is also at the key of the heart of Confucianism. It's in fact the term that is used in both the Mandarin language and in the Korean language is the same in the Bible to describe the righteousness of God which is in Christ. It's a word that is borrowed from the Confucian classics. So it comes then in the ear of the ordinary people with that kind of meaning all built into it. And the danger can be then that when they hear about the righteousness of God, they're starting to think about the fivefold relationships and how to have proper relationships with your older brother, how to have proper relationships with the king, how to have proper relationships with the wife, all these kinds of things, with the older brother. And what is missing then is the whole concept of God as the one who is just and holy and altogether different and set apart from sinners. That's missing because we haven't focused on it. What words, for example, are you going to use in your culture to translate theos? Are you aware of the fact that that the word that may be used in your Bible, in your cultural language, to translate that is a word that already has a prior meaning in the ears of those to whom you're sharing the gospel? Are you sensitive to the fact that when they hear your word, they don't hear all of the biblical content that you have back here but don't verbalize? Instead, they hear only what they're used to in terms of their cultural setting. So the message gets blurred. Among the Tiv people in Nigeria, with whom Norm's worked a lot, apparently there is a traditional cultic name for the high god.
Eugene Rubin, whom I mentioned yesterday, uses this term, Alando, right?
Yeah, I don't know much about the team. But...
Oh, good.
Well, then, as I was saying...
Yeah, you can really pull out your lecture.
Okay, now, actually, this didn't come from Rubin. I was... but...
I have his book in my briefcase.
Oh. Well, another source I use. You have to establish your identity as a teacher. Aondo was apparently the traditional cultic name for the high god among the Tiv people. And this high god among the Tiv abides in distant majesty. He's what would be called the distant god or the hidden god, the Deus Otiosus. Because of this high god depend the blessing or the cursing of the whole Tiv people. Now, the missionary, in going to the Tiv people, took that name in order to translate Theos in the Bible, in the Tiv Bible. So, says Rubing, both the traditional view, that is the African traditional view, has now been colored by the Christian use of the term, and the Christian view of God has been colored by the traditional one. You have this mixing. You know, cultures, remember, are not things that sort of always exist separately, but whenever worldviews come into contact, there is a mixing that takes place. And since cultures are always dynamic things, our struggle is how to keep the mixing from taking place in such a way that the Christian view or the Christian meaning, you know, doesn't get infiltrated by unbiblical concepts that may come from the culture that it's coming in contact with. So, for example, says Rubing, there is a fatalism among the Tiv people. He says they will they shrug their shoulders when they face adversity, and they say, with all the overtones of the old worldview, it's Aondo. You know, what can you do? Sort of a Doris Day theology, you know. Que sera, sera. Now, this fatalism provides a means of absolving one from personal blame if there's a calamity. It's not my fault. It's Aondo. And then you can proof text that, of course, with Romans 8:28. It's Aondo's will. What can I do to withstand the will of Aondo? And in doing that, then, Aondo's will becomes very arbitrary, and it is useless, says Rubing, to attempt to contravene his design. You don't know it, and there's no way you can get in touch. He's the high, distant god. He's not with us. So, says Rubing, among the Tiv Christians, there is a lack of use of personal ability and personal opportunity. And this is frequently excused on theological grounds. And you can see the mixing. Do you have anything similar to that among the Hausa, Norm?
Oh, yeah. We have exactly that same. Huh? Our problem with our people is that they're using the Hausa language, which is really a lot of Islamic Arabic roots, and all the words for our Christian expression are taken directly from Islam, including Allah and everything, right down the line. So then I think they combine that with their animistic, which is very close to the Islamic view of God as being some great fate, you know, out there.
Yeah.
And so anything that happens virtually is, well, nothing you can do. I mean, it's just the way it is.
Yeah.
I think that's just in African culture all over, this fatalism.
You know, one of the things that hits me is in reading through this stuff again, I wonder if this is part of the reason why, at least I sense very often, a difficulty on the part of African evangelical churches to sort of get involved in the process of, call it, nation building or development, or putting it more biblically, to function as leaven or salt, you know, in their society. God sort of is so distant and passive, as it were, that they end up being passive too. You know, corruption, governments, a Christian political leader goes bad. Well, what can you do about it? You know, it's the will of God, and so you tend to withdraw into the church, and the church becomes kind of cocoon that surrounds you and keeps you safe from the imbalance. I get the same feeling, for example, when I struggle with the Korean church's relationship to the state at the present time, in the sense that that there's more than just what I would feel to be an incorrect reading of Romans 13 involved. There's also a lot of pacifism that comes from Confucianism, in which that influences the church and makes it sort of stand back and say, well, what can you do about it? This isn't the business of the church anyway. To give one more example, I think Tippett used this one. The animists, remember, have come from a world of power encounter. Presumably they need a god who speaks and demonstrates with power. Now, the preaching of a purely ethical gospel will not touch them. But a life transformed by the living power of God will lead to a new ethic. And so you'll find very frequently, says Tippett, the rise within these settings, animistic settings, therefore, of these African independent church movements, and centering, as they often do, around a power figure, the prophet leader of the group. And his message, then, is usually one that is centered frequently around the concept of power, the power of the divine word, but ministered through him. So that you see an attempt through all of that to breach, this kind of passive gap, but it's coming the wrong way. You know, it doesn't flow out of a biblical direction of concern. And that means something's gone wrong with where we've come from.
When we were at Vietnam, we saw a film, the African Independent Churches, and Tom and I were talking on our way back. After seeing the film, we said that the only problem is the title. It should be called the Independent African Religions rather than Churches.
One of the struggles, I think, that we haven't really dealt with statistically in terms of demographics is how ready to see the African independent movements. David Barrett's book that some of you probably worked with through Roger, I think includes all those movements in his argument that Africa south of the Sahara by the end of this century will have become Christian. And that's a big question about just how Christian are these African independent churches. But Hank.
Yeah, it's just that each one has to be evaluated separately, because there are some that are quite close biblically. Often they've been because of some kind of personality clash between leadership. But then there are others that are just way off and left field that can be called Christian. So that's why it's difficult to say when you start compiling statistics.
Good point.
How many of these churches are there?
They call them 6,000.
6,000.
And they're all independent. They don't have any relationship with...
No relationship to a Western or foreign mission.
But I mean relationship to each other.
Some of them are large enough and are cross-national. For example, the Kimbangu's church is one of the largest, if not the largest, in Africa. And that moves across all kinds of country lines. But many of them are quite localized. David Barrett's first book was called Schism and Renewal in Africa. And it's the history of 2,000 of these independent churches in Kenya alone. Now, you can document all the data from another area where the independent churches have grown significantly is South Africa and Southern Africa. And a scholar who has done a lot of work, two scholars have done a lot of work in the South African setting, are G.C. Oosthuizen and Bengt Sunkler. And... Oosthuizen is a Calvinist. He's a member of the Afrikaner Church. And he has a book called Erdmans, published about 10 years ago, called Post-Christianity in Africa, in which he also tries to evaluate the African independent churches. That's a good book for those of you who haven't come across it. And the other one is a very famous Lutheran bishop, Bengt Sunkler. And he has a number of books out on this area, One of the most recent ones is called Zulu Zion, and it's about an African independent church which is formed among the Zulu people. Part of my frustration sometimes with the movements is not so much with the movements as with what seems to me a really heavy, almost across the boards, reluctance on the part of evangelicals to want to touch them at all. I think some of that may come from the thing that Hank's warning us against, you know, our tendency to sort of lump them all into one group, sort of as what we would call here in the United States cults. And, you know, you don't necessarily say, I'm going to become a Jehovah's Witness, you know, so I can evangelize within the kingdom halls. But on the other hand, there are many of these churches that have even more than other churches in Africa and the third world, profound lack of teaching. And this could conceivably be a place where missionaries could fulfill a very useful function. Norm?
The difficulty with that, we have one particularly in our area, is that the church that I work with, for example, and the organization just simply won't.
Yeah.
They'll throw you out of there faster than you can take it.
You've almost got to come out uniquely to work with them.
You've got to come out.
Yeah.
You can't do, because they've usually broken off from the group that works with, and they're seen as really.
Yeah.
Maybe then, as part of mission strategy, if that's true, then our boards have got to be encouraged to think about designating people whose job would be specifically to try and make connections with those churches for that they feel they can for purposes of instruction. The Mennonites have done a great deal of work in some of these churches, and they are the only group I know of that has sort of specifically put them on their agenda, have gone in among the churches and engaged in a very fruitful teaching ministry. More recently, one that's closer to us, some of you may be interested in, a Westminster graduate of about 6-7 years ago by the name of Keith Underhill is working in Nairobi in Kenya. He is planning Reformed Baptist churches there in Nairobi. And Keith has been approached by one of the largest African independent churches located in the north of Kenya, who have come to him and asked him to be their teacher. And some of you who took the course last semester in Christian ministry in the third world had an opportunity to look at his proposed curriculum agenda for the teaching in that school church. I will say no more. But, you know, there are people who are attempting to build those bridges and make those connections. But often, as I said, their very existence comes because of some blurring in terms of the message itself that I think ought to put us alert to it. Okay, third minor point here. There can also be a blurring at the acceptor end, that is, by the convert. And, you know, biblically, the example of Paul and Barnabas at Lystra, Acts chapter 14, I think it's a beautiful example of this. The people there, the two men heal the cripple, and the people at Lystra take the healing to mean that the two evangelists were the Greek gods, Mercury and Jupiter, sort of come in human form. The proclamation had been faithfully given, but it was misunderstood by the receptor. Now, Tippett then comments, this incident reminds the evangelist of the great need for being aware of the worldview of the listener. The miracle had been reinterpreted in terms of the Lystra mythology. And this, I think, is the core problem of all interpretation. Or, put it another way, of translation. Every word selected, the word for God, the word for spirit, the word for son of God, the word for sin, the word for love, the word for atonement, all these words come from a non-biblical worldview. You don't invent these words. This, in a real way, was the great advantage of the English language, and specifically the King James translation. They could do that, because of the correlations or the connections between the Greek language and the English language. So, for example, the translators of the King James and the English usage, rather than fiddle with how to translate baptizo, just simply transliterated it. And it fit into the, fitted comfortably into our English usage, but still, you know, the whole question of the meaning we struggled with. In Korea, for example, that translation question is a burning question. There's violent disagreement, usually between the Baptists and everybody else on this question. And so the Baptists have their own word, their own translation for baptize, a word which is shared, as far as I know, by no one else within the ecclesiastical world in Korea. Okay. All right, let's go on to number three, and I think that's Ian, right? Yeah.
Chapter 5.
Right. Yeah. But in terms of your outline, we're working now on the third magnetic point of religion, okay? That would be I and the riddle of my existence.
Babink begins by just drawing out some of the common day occurrences that illustrate to us the fact that in life we're aware of the fact that there are active aspects of life and there are passive aspects of life. In the passive area, for instance, just in a biological sense, we have no control over the fact our heart beats. Digestion, for instance, is a non-controllable function. And he carries that even to the point of saying the country that we're born in, for instance, is something we have no control over, the family that we're born into. Even the education that we get is something that's given to us. So there are definitely passive aspects of our lives that draw out that principle in the human experience, passivity. At the same time, he does make clear that even some of these passive experiences that we have in life do involve some active participation, such as breathing. The respiratory function is passive, yet at the same time we can stop breathing for a certain period of time, hopefully not too long. And even related to digestion, we can, obviously digestion is a passive thing, but at the same time we can control that by eating or not eating. So again, he's just drawing in common day occurrences to draw out this aspect of activity and passivity. He says, in terms of man's experience, probably the area of activity that we sense the most is the fact that we react to the circumstances and to the conditions that we have in life. If I get a gas bill from the gas company that's five times what it should be, then my active aspect of life comes to play, and I usually get on the phone and holler at the lady on the other end of the phone, who is the woman at the gas works, which illustrates the fact that we do have this reaction process. Things happen to us, but at the same time we react to them. His point is that this relationship between activity and passivity has a tremendous implication in the area of religion, and it's a question that religion has to address. He illustrates the way some religious systems deal with this relationship. He begins with Mesopotamian religions, or the astral religions, those religions that draw heavily from the stars, the heavens, and the control that the heavens and the stars have over man's experience. And in the relationship between the heavens and man in Mesopotamian religions, man is viewed as just a small part of the cosmic family. And heaven obviously takes precedent over anything that man does. The gods who are controlling everything are the ones who even put men into power, and they can either remove their blessing or can continue their blessing on this person, which either determines his success or failure. Basically speaking, he has no control over these things. Man is completely dependent upon the powers of the astral functions in the heavens. So he is, in a sense, victimized by a capricious system that's, if we like this guy for a while, then we'll give him power and blessing. If we don't, we'll just remove it. So that, in a sense, the active aspect of this person is very limited. He really can't act. He's a victim of this great power that hangs over him. He illustrates that Hinduism is quite different. For one thing, it's not astral. And from another perspective, in the Hindu system, man is not divorced from the world of gods and demons and heroes and giants and the forces of order and chaos. They're found within human society, and they're actually found within the individual himself. He's a part of the cosmos. It's not them and us. He is a part of the process and a part of the cosmos. Now, he illustrates, or he brings out the fact that this does not negate the fact that man is sort of carried along in this current or in this river of the cosmos and is somewhat helpless. But at the same time, he draws some illustrations from particularly a story of Draupadi and Padambas that talks of this human predicament of the individual being caught in the cosmic powers and being forced along by them. But at the same time, there's illustrations of people rebelling against these cosmic forces and cosmic powers. Even the illustrations themselves, man is viewed as a wooden puppet on a string, which is a very unnatural concept. Also, a bird being held by a string attached to a tree, or a tree falling into a raging stream. Obviously the natural situation for a bird is to have freedom, to be able to fly where it wants to fly, and trees are not supposed to be inundated by water. But the reality of life says that we are birds that are tied by the cosmic forces, and we are trees that have been engulfed by the cosmic flood, and we're being pushed along. But at the same time, there's that desire to rebel against this. And so in the Hindu system, at least there's a dialogue between the reality of the activity and passivity. He brought out an interesting point about the concept of tragedy in the Hindu system in comparison to the obvious emphasis of the tragedy in the Greek system. And his point was that within the Hindu system, there's no concept of absolute contrast, where we see in the Greek system, you've got the individual fighting against the gods, and it's them and us. And somehow the individual in the Greek system is being unfairly dealt with. And his only reaction, of course, is to fight against these powers that try and inundate him. Whereas the concept in the Hindu system is that man addresses his relationship in a more uncertain way to the cosmos. Hinduism also thwarts the tendency of total control through the concept of transcendence, that there is that part of man that can transcend and, in a sense, stand as an independent observer of life and not be swallowed up in this system. This disattachment, so the person is never completely consumed, or at least has the potential never to be completely consumed in the process, where this is not true in the Greek system. You have no choice. You are consumed, and therefore the only thing you can do is to fight back, whereas we have the concepts of the Greek tragedies. Then he goes in to illustrate this in the Islamic system. And I think I sense from what he's doing in Chapter 5 is illustrating how these things are addressed in the different religious systems. But he's also trying to show us that these issues and problems are not really addressed well, that it's kind of a futile question that's never really dealt with and never really satisfactorily answered. In the Islamic system, of course, the big question is, are all of our actions predestined by Allah, and are we ourselves entirely powerless? And he goes on to illustrate some of the ways that this question has been addressed and the different ways that Islamic tradition has looked at that question. He talks about the Qadarites, I assume I'm pronouncing that correctly, who argue for man's self-determination, because not to argue for man's self-determination would produce an immorality. In other words, if there's no self-determination, if we're completely passive, then we may as well just go ahead and do what we want, because Allah willed it anyway. So it tends to remove the whole conflict away from human responsibility. Later, this was adopted by another group, and they decided that not all of human life was a product of Allah's qadar, or divine command. After all, if it was, how could Allah righteously punish people? It would be impossible if everything that we did and our life's patterns could be attributed to the qada or the divine command. So that's the way they get around this apparent contradiction. Then he talked about orthodox Islam. And the solution, which is kind of interesting, the solution as far as they're concerned is couched in the word kasb, K-A-S-B. Is that pronounced correctly? Or is that close enough? Don't worry about it. And that's the idea of acquisition or appropriation. So man is in the process of acquiring or appropriating the things that Allah has provided for him. So that, granted, man is somewhat passive because Allah is providing these circumstances, is providing these situations for him, but man is active because he acquires them and he appropriates them. So that's how this issue is dealt within the context of Orthodox Islam. And it almost sounds like the parallel theological debate that we have, I think, with the Calvinistic circles, is the ideas of appropriation. I think those who perhaps would have more of an Arminian perspective would say that man does have something to do in salvation because he has to appropriate the gospel. He has to accept it or ingest it. Whereas I think more strongly Reformed people would say that God gives the person even the ability to do that. So it's much more passive from that standpoint. Towards the end of his discussion, he brings out the point that the most important question facing religious systems is how do religious systems consider human life? Is man completely passive? Therefore, human life is almost a secondary thing to consider and the deity is primary? Or is there some dignity? Is there some reality to the whole aspect of human life? Are we just amoebas, blobs, something that's pushed along by wind or by wave? Or, in a real sense, is there a certain dignity and power and intrinsic value in human life? He brings out a point made by Reinhold Niebuhr, who said that man is unique among all creatures because he has the ability of self-transcendence. He can sense the difference between the I and the other. He senses that he is different from the rest of the world around him, and that he is unique in that sense from other created beings. And I think there's something to be said for that. Although he did bring out that this was rejected by Spinoza. Spinoza felt that God is the ultimate ground, and being in the universe is perfect reason, and that we on our deepest being are one with him. So there's no separation between the I and the other, because God is the ultimate all-inclusive ground and we are in him. Therefore, all that confusing stuff says that this concept of the I and the other and man's ability to see himself as apart from the other is really not valid in his system. But again, restated, as Bhavik comes back to again, he says the key statement is, what does man experience when he uses the word I, and by so doing keeps aloof from the world as other? And what does that all mean? In considering this question, he said there's various reactions that people have in religious systems. And the first reaction is that they do protest against the idea of being just a particle in the cosmos. Naturally, people reject that idea and fight against that. And he's illustrated that by the religious debates, either within Islam or Hinduism, the concept of the Greek tragedy. The people deep down inside really don't like the concept that there's some kind of a particle or some kind of an object that can be pushed in whatever direction within the cosmos. The second reaction, which is almost the other side of the coin, is that in a certain sense, it's kind of handy to feel as though you're a particle in the cosmos, because then you can adopt a fatalism and a passivity to the point where you say, I'm not responsible. It's not my fault. I have no control over it, which is something we just mentioned before. He mentioned that Hinduism attempts to fight against this reality in the concept of the karma, which, if I remember rightly, is the effect of action. It's the automatic law of justice. But even within the Hindu system, ultimately, the karma is applied to us. We really don't have any ultimate control over the karma. Am I interpreting that correctly? I'm getting a half nod from Palus, so I guess I haven't made any heretical statements yet. And he brings out an interesting point at the end, and he talks about the Maya, which is the Hindu concept that our life is really kind of a casual projected dream that a god has for us, and that granted we may have some input or some control when it comes to karma, but even ultimately he illustrated this via story in his chapter, and I won't go into all the details, but the point of the story was that the person's experience in life was really just a dream that a god had had, and there was no way that the person could avoid the eventual outcome of that dream. And that, in essence, is what he says in Chapter 5 in this whole discussion. Are we going to have questions and discuss it that way? Or? Okay, does anybody have questions? You can throw some of these things around.
How about, do you see Ian in terms of your ministry in the city? Do you hear this question being raised? How?
I think there's a sense in the contacts that I have with people in the city, a high sense of fatalism. And I don't think it's necessarily borrowed from any particular religious tradition. I think it's borrowed from misconceptions that we have in our country concerning God. I've worked with young people in this city who see their lot in life as something that they have absolutely no control over, and that they've exhausted blaming mother, father, aunts and uncles, etc., and now they finally come to the ultimate extreme, and that is to blame God and say, it's his fault, he's the one who did this to me, and in a sense, what can I do? I'm a victim of circumstance, and ultimately God is the God of circumstance. Therefore, the God that you're preaching to me is one that I want nothing to do with, because he's given me a raw deal. So I think there's a sense in which that's addressed. To react to that, I think it's significant, and he brings this out even more clearly in Chapter 13, is the biblical concept that where the Bible doesn't necessarily address the idea of how much will does a human have, but how much responsibility does the individual human being have. And I think in dealing with people who have that perception of God, we've got to help them understand responsibility. And then they can begin to understand this concept of activity and what they can do themselves, and give them a more balanced perspective on who God is and his dealings with men.
I think many Koreans have a fatalism and a passivity. And I talked to some Buddhists, and why don't you accept Jesus Christ? Mm-hmm. In the time that they said that if I accept Jesus, and then my God, you know, the Buddhist, the Buddha or another, the supreme being, give me a disease. Disaster to him or his family, so I can't accept Jesus Christ. So I think there are many, they have another religion, but the fatalism that comes upon their mankind mentality.
The Hindu idea of karma is not that they are not responsible for their action. What it says is that even if they do some good deed today, its results may not be visible in this life. It may come after, you know, 100,000 cycles of birth and rebirth, etc. So it leads to some kind of fatalism. Even if I'm going to do something good, what is going to happen? Nothing is going to happen to me today, tomorrow, or in this life. So who bothers? Next life I may be a bird or an animal.
And isn't it true that if they don't fulfill the karma, that in reincarnation they'll be dropped to a lower caste, perhaps as a punishment for
not
doing properly?
Not as a result of your actions in this life.
Mm.
It depends upon the cumulative result of your past action in all the previous lives put together.
Well, again, I sense from reading this chapter that Bhavink is trying to illustrate that religions in general really cannot satisfactorily answer the question of what is human life, what is the relationship between activity and passivity, and what about this question of I and the other? I mean, exactly what is the human existence as it relates to supreme deities? And I think my feeling from all of these is that they all eventually lead to a fatalism, and they all have within them that trapdoor you can push where the bottom can fall out and you can say I had no control. Whereas as he goes into his discussion in chapter 13, which is obviously related, Christianity has a different perspective. And the reason being, in my perspective from reading it, is that Christianity deals with responsibility in very specific terms, which gives a person a matrix to begin to understand how they do relate to God.